Nooks is the first agent workspace for sales, a unified platform where AI agents and human sales reps work together in real time. Instead of getting buried in manual tasks, you work alongside AI that prospects, prioritizes, and drafts outreach for you. When it comes to outbound, stop managing sequences and start selling with Nooks. Visit nooks.ai today. That's nooks.ai.
This is the Sales Gravy Podcast. Hi, I'm Jeb Blunt, best-selling author of Fanatical Prospecting, Objections, Sales EQ, and Inked, and I'm here to help you open more doors, close bigger deals, and rock your commission check.
Welcome back to the Sales Gravy Podcast. I'm Jeb Blunt Jr., and today's guest has conducted more criminal polygraphs than any Secret Service agent in history. But before I get into that, I want to give you the opportunity to be even better than you are right now. Because if you haven't invested in sales skill development or yourself or your team this year, you need to go to Sales Gravy University. It is the proven learning platform for the largest, most elite sales organizations in the world, and it has more than 1,500 hours of on-demand sales training content along with live classes we teach every single week. So go to learn.salesgravy.com, that's learn.salesgravy.com, and you can use the code SGPOD, that's code SGPOD, to access any course for free right now. Go to learn.salesgravy.com and access that free course on Sales Gravy University, the world's leading sales learning engine. Brad Beeler has spent 25 years in a world that very few of us can imagine in its entirety. Brad is a retired Secret Service special agent who, as I mentioned, conducted more criminal polygraph exams than any other agent in the agency's history. And he has his new book, Tell Me Everything. That's the title, Tell Me Everything. Brad breaks down the strategies he used to, I'm using air quotes now, if you're on YouTube, you can watch this, sell jail to criminals. And today, he's here to tell us some stories about these federal level tactics for building trust and reading human behavior so that you can help transform your sales team into a more elite force. Brad, welcome to the show.
Jeb, thank you so much for having me on. It's an honor.
I can't wait to get into the conversation because this book that you have written is one of those sort of in the space of never split the difference, these really awesome conversations you have had with the people that I would never interact with, I hope, in my entire life. But you have some really interesting conversations that sort of taught you lessons about trust and building and communication that I think is applicable to the business world. You start off with a story in it's like the very first chapter of your book, and you call it the horns and halos effect. I just want you to tell us a story of what the horns and halos effect is and how you just figured out this lesson in this strange environment you walked into.
Yeah, Jeb, I appreciate you asking. So horns and halos, it's been with us for millennia, but it basically was a self-defense mechanism that we would quickly put horns and halos on somebody to protect us. 300,000 years ago, if something was rustling in the bushes, we'd use our eyes, we'd use our ears to affix a horn or a halo to that situation. Said, we need to climb a tree. Does the tribe need to come help us? And that works really good in those types of self-defense situations. We're walking down an alley at night, something like that. But unfortunately, we tend to use this in personal and professional relationships, that gut instinct, so on and so forth, that in business, we're like, oh, my gut tells me this. That's not really how that was developed. And sometimes it leads us astray. And a situation I had on a search warrant kind of personifies that. My partner and I, we went into a house. We were clearing the house and we came across a pit bull and we came across a chihuahua. Obviously, there is stereotypes out there about pit bulls. So my front sight focus was on that pit bull. I was very scared because it was not happy to see me. I don't want to have to shoot a family pet, something along those lines. But while I was focused on that pit bull, I had put horns on it and I put metaphorical halo on the chihuahua. The chihuahua kind of crept around and it crept and it crept and it crept and it got right behind me and it jumped up and it grabbed me right between the legs. And I won't say exactly where it grabbed me between the legs, but it was dangling there. I had to holster up and my partner is just sitting there laughing at me, not worried about tactics, whatever the case may be, but for the next 10 or 15 seconds, just laughing while I was removing this thing that I had put halo on, right? That to me was pretty self-explanatory, is that you got to be very, very careful about first impressions. We want to make a great first impression. And if we get some time today, there's some hacks, some scientific based things that we can do to make a great first impression. We also have to understand people make first impressions upon us. And when we put horns and halos, fix those too quickly, we can sometimes misread.
I imagine that in the sales world, so as we, you know, we're talking to account executives and businesses who are making cold calls and going out and finding new business and having these first time appointments, that first impression feels really important to portray the chihuahua in the situation, to be the halo, because when you see a salesperson, you sort of have the pit bull in mind. You sort of, they're the shark. They're going to be asking you for business at some point. You know it. Explain what it's like from the receiver's end. So you assigned horns and halos to these different actors. I assume that buyers are doing the same thing. Yeah, what are some of those hacks that we can use to help us sort of portray the right version of ourselves in that first impression more often than not? The statistical win probability, yep, we want to increase.
Yeah, absolutely. You put that right. Win probability, because you're definitely not going to win them all. What we're trying to do is we're trying to work around the margins. So the first thing is I want to use all my senses as best as possible. One of the things that we really lost in COVID was the ability to make a great handshake. I know it sounds silly, but with recency bias, we remember the first thing that happens and we remember the last thing that happens in interaction. Well, what is that? That's typically, if you're in person, that's a handshake. And what's the worst handshake? It's wet. It's cold. It's either you hit the bones because you came in at the wrong angle, or you're checking someone's pulse because you came in too shallow. It lacks eye contact. It lingers. Okay. Wet fish, we've heard commonly talked about. So there's certain things that you can do. For instance, if I'm seated at an event, I'll sometimes put my hand under my hamstring, and that warms it up and it also dries it, so that when I stand, now you're going to get a dry handshake. I actually put antiperspirant on my right hand. 99% of handshakes are with the right hand. So I put antiperspirant on my right hand. You're never going to get a wet handshake from me, because there are times when, after talking to horrible people, being around presidents, whatever the case may be, the moment sometimes is still large. I'm still going to get nervous, and I don't want that hand to betray me. So I'm going to have a nice dry handshake. I'm also not going to warm it up in front of them where I kind of act like I'm starting a fire with my hands. That just says to the other person, oh, they're nervous and they're trying to control for it. But if I know I'm going to go into another room and meet somebody, I'm going to be rubbing my hands together before I walk into that room, because I want it to be a warm handshake. I'm going to have about 90% eye contact. I'm going to come at a 45% angle. I'm going to slightly tilt my hand to the right. And what that does, that 2 o'clock, is it exposes the lightest part of my hand, that white part of my hand. Race, color, creed, ethnicity, it doesn't matter. It's the lightest part of your body. It's a flash. It says, I don't have a weapon. I'm not going to hurt you. It's also a better landing area for that other person. And it's not a shake. It's just a subtle 1 second hold. Too many times people do the United Nations peace accords where they sit there and they shake people for 3 or 4 seconds. Yeah, let's don't do that. And then we disconnect, and then we ventrally front. What I mean by ventrally front, Jeb, is a dog, when it's comfortable with you, what does it do? It rolls over and shows you its belly. All right. What a lot of times in law enforcement, the people I train is they blade their body, which is good in law enforcement, but it's not good. It's not a good friend sign. Mm. Also, soft eyes. I want to have a subtle smile. I don't want to have that furrowed brow. Neutral codes negative when we meet people. So as far as an initial interaction, when I'm coming towards someone, I'm going to have my body language be controlled. I don't want to be jittery. I'm going to have a subtly deeper tone, and I'm going to slow down my voice, just, or my rate of speech, subtly. If you do those things, the science says you're going to have a better one-on-one interaction.
That's so powerful. The ability to present in such a way that builds trust before you even had a conversation with somebody. And go back to the chihuahua and the pit bull. You misassigned the horns and the halos. Maybe as someone who reads the situation, you're walking into your first appointment with the prospect, or you're getting on a call with somebody who you've never met before, and you're evaluating the room maybe in the similar fashion that, you know, someone in law enforcement might walk into a room and you see a pit bull potentially, or you see a chihuahua potentially. What are some of the things that we can look for and maybe start to adjust so that we can bring the friendlier side of that person to the forefront of that conversation? What are some of those things that we could do?
Yeah, so one thing we got to be careful about is we do have to understand it's all within the frame. The best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And the more interactions we can have with somebody, the better take we are going to get. Well, I looked at a lot of scams when I was in the Secret Service. They're usually based upon scarcity. Okay, you need it now. Time-based consequences. They would prime the situation. They would also have external validity to them as a person. Hmm. That is just ripe for people taking advantage. And that's obviously the manipulation side of influence. we want to use influence for good. Okay. We want to present ourselves for good. So once again, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. We have to be very, very careful about, we want to prep for our interactions with all those social media things that are out there, just Googling somebody's name or a business. It's amazing what you can understand about somebody before you go in the interaction, but understand the people that we're talking to are doing the same thing against us. If you look at dating scams, if you look at Bitcoin scams right now, these people are coming to you armed with this information because we don't have diaries stuck under a bed like we did 30 years ago. Our diaries are online. So they come at you and they know how to be the mythical Prince Charming to get you to open up your pocketbook or, once again, in a dating type situation to take advantage of you because you're like, oh, this person is perfect. No, they're just the perfect version of who you would want to interact with.
Mm. Okay, so the preparation is just a key to allowing yourself to have the right sort of mindset walking into conversations when you can and in those situations. You mentioned the scams. You've dealt with a lot of scams, and I think that's time-based and desperations or speaking to desperation. We see these all the time, but it's strange to – I mean, you sort of have this relationship where they text me or they call me or they email me, and I go, oh, my God, another one, and I sort of put it into a box. You actually had to deal with this on a ground level. You met someone called the King of Counterfeit, and you got an autograph. So tell us a little bit about – that
yeah,
situation.
It's been a fun ride because this is almost 25 years ago now, right at 25 years ago when I met Art, and I call him by his first name now because I've grown to talk to him since then. But it was one of these things where we were getting destroyed. I was in Chicago, was my first duty station, and we were really getting hit hard. The Midwest was getting hit hard by somebody that had done a very good job of cutting through mental heuristics that people have as far as shortcuts with looking at counterfeit. They would hold it up to the light, you run the pen against it, you feel the paper, and then, oh, okay, this is good to go. Well, he was able to basically put a note together that had some tracing paper that looked like the hologram. He had some stuff that looked like the strip. It felt right. It was able to be kind of inconclusive on the pen, the counterfeit pen. So he was going through some of these shortcuts that people took, and he was really beating us up to the tune of a couple million dollars. And he was a ghost. All I knew is his name was Art, and he was very proud of his work. He was in. He viewed this like a lot of our counterfeiters historically, that it was an art form. Wasn't just putting it on a Xerox and running off notes. And we tracked him for the longest time. And it wasn't until he had an article in Rolling Stone with his face on a $100 bill that we're like, wow, this guy is legit. Okay. And so that kind of really got me into, we got to catch this guy. And one day he was picked up in Chicago. And I thought, how am I going to, I think I was 27 at the time, young kid. And I thought, this guy thinks he's the best counterfeiter in the world. He's got, you know, these American Greed, Vice Magazine, you know, all these things making him out to be the biggest, baddest. How am I going to look good in his eyes, right? He viewed himself as Robin Hood. He would give back some of the proceeds. Well, Robin Hood can't get caught by any sheriff. He needs the sheriff of Nottingham, right? So it's one of those things where I told him I flew in on the Gulfstream, and really I had driven in on the 1991 Plymouth Acclaim with three ball tires from the suburbs of Chicago. But once again, I got to play to the ego a little bit, right? And we met, and he was a little standoffish at first, but I played total fanboy. You know, I had the article, I had him sign the Rolling Stone article, you know, you know, just as a memento. But that validated what he had done. Is you got to understand, people are in different headspaces. People do different things, and what people do in their leisure time. I spend a lot of time with that. For him, this was his leisure activity, but it was also how he made his money. So I wanted him to feel good about that. So I praised him. Mm. I've also learned, Jeff, that when you let people teach you about something, I don't care if it's somebody that's making drugs, if it's somebody that's hurting people, whatever the case may be, if I can find something in their life for them to teach me about it, they don't feel like they're being interrogated. They feel human and they feel open. And it's amazing what they will talk to you when you have them teach. And I had literally for the next hour and a half, I had him teach me how he made this counterfeit. It was a defining moment for him, but it was also a confession. And I think in sales, you need to do that as well. Like I ask everybody in an interview, hey, John, can you come up with three reasons why you think somebody may have done X, Y, and Z? And it's amazing how many times they will subconsciously tell me why they did that bad thing. And now instead of carpet bombing my approach, now I'm going to be a surgical strike. When somebody walks on a car lot, what should you do? Hey, what are the three things you're looking for in a car? Well, if they tell you, I want whatever dependability, I want resale value, and I want something that's going to be able to lug around the kids, are you going to sell them the Corvette? Absolutely not. So you got to know what brings them here. And if you can shroud that and you can do that professionally, you'd be surprised as what people will offer up so that you can put them in the right car. It's not, once again, it's not about manipulating. It's about having the best time on target possible.
But I think it's like The Talented Mr. Ripley. I'm sort of conflating these movies together, but it's got Tom Hanks and there's this guy who is very famous for the counterfeiting and sort of the scamming around the world. I think of like someone who is, you know, printing whatever they're doing, kind of that artistic process of getting it out there. Are they doing this at banks? And then you're sort of, they got picked up by doing that. And then you're running into a conversation where they see horns, like they're looking at horns and then you're asking a question. So what kinds of questions are you asking a person to get them to teach you? What are the kind of the mile markers of a conversation where you know, as someone who's done a lot of this, that, okay, I'm getting them to a point where they're going to want to teach me how they do these things, whether subconsciously or consciously doing it. What does that conversation start to sound like?
Yeah, so I slow roll into that. So I've got an acronym that I call FEEL, Family, Education, Employment, Leisure. Too often we get into these transactional conversations. We may be on a plane, we may be wherever at work, where we ask, how'd you do this week? What'd you do this weekend? What are you going to do this weekend, right? Those little, how's the weather? You know, those things that you do in the doctor's office when you're meeting somebody in passing time. Those are not effective conversations. So I usually will start when I start talking about family. But the problem is you can't choose the parents that you were born to. A lot of the people that I talk to don't have the Truman Show type life where they've got 2.2 kids in the white picket fence. So I will have to ask them, who taught you right and wrong? Okay, who raised you? And you'd be surprised. It's usually an aunt or an uncle, whatever the case may be. Employment, depending on, you know, where you're at in the world, you may have certain opportunities as far as employment. So just spending time talking about jobs, a lot of people work 40 hours a week. They don't want to talk about the job anymore. Same thing about education. You know, where you were from, maybe it dictated where you went to school, state, tech, even if a lot of people I talked to didn't go to college. So they went to the junior high and the high school that is where they're at. So there wasn't a lot of choice there. But you'd be surprised, Jeb, what people do in that 40 to 60 hours a week that they can choose what they want to do. And here's where it gets tricky. So if let's just play this out with you. Jeb, what do you like to do in your free time?
I'm a big guitar player. Well, I'm 5'10". So I'm not big, but I'm 5'10".
Okay. You're an average size guitar player.
Yeah.
Okay. What got you into that?
You know, when I was in college, I picked up a guitar when I was 18 years old. I thought, this is going to help me get dates. It's going to help me be more attractive.
Around the campfire?
Around the campfire and you know, just like in the dorm rooms and where when I went to college. And it turns out very, very little dates does a guitar that's poorly played produce. It's just not easy to get dates when you can't strum a G chord.
So is this acoustic? Is this acoustic guitar that we're talking about?
Yeah, acoustic, electric, both of them, but primarily acoustic.
Okay. If you had to say one person you model yourself after, who would that be?
Oh my God, model myself after?
In a perfect world.
In a perfect world?
One person.
Man, I mean, Jimmy. It's hard to beat Jimmy.
Okay, you know? That's a good starting point, right?
Yeah.
So what is it about playing the guitar that it's so enjoyable for you?
I've always liked to sing. So I like to sing in the car and, you know, in the shower. And I always like, I'm listening to music constantly and singing it. And I've just been that way since I was a kid. But I've never had the musical ability to kind of back that up. And I'm not a great singer, so it doesn't really work well on its own. The guitar allowed me to play my music that I like to listen to and do it myself. And then eventually I got good enough or skilled enough that I was able to like start practicing chords and progressions and all kinds of different pentatonic scales, all the scales. And now I'm learning music theory. So now I'm in a place where the enjoyment honestly is just the journey of kind of unlocking a new neuron in my brain that I hadn't found before.
Okay. So what did we just do, Jeb? What did we just learn about you? Okay. We started with what do you like to do? And then now we got to why do you like to do it?
Yeah.
And we're talking about expanding neurons in your brain, right? It would be very, very tough for me to do that if I wouldn't just let you have the microphone and educate me on that, right? What do we do though in conversations? Let's say I play the guitar too. I would ask you that question and you'd say, I like to play the guitar. And people are like, yeah, me too. And then the spotlight is on me. It goes away from you. You don't get that dopamine. I mean, when you were explaining learning chords and just playing, you had a smile on your face. You were bathing in dopamine. And who are you associating that dopamine with? Me. The most wonderful voice in your mind is your own voice. So I want you to speak. I want you to talk. I want you to educate me. And people can say, Brad, you're such a good listener. No, I'm just shutting up. I'm not saying anything. I'm just doing follow-up questions. And before you know it, I know a little bit about you. And here's where we connect. I don't play the guitar, Jeb. I love Brazilian jiu-jitsu. You know why I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu? Because it gets me away from the day-to-day and it helps me get a new skill and learn a different neuron and connect my neurons at a different level. We're doing this thing for the same underside of the iceberg reason that I never would have known if I wouldn't have let you just educate me. So too many times in sales, we don't ask enough questions to understand, why is this person in front of us? What does this person really need? It's too transactional, right? I have this widget. You're calling, you're a prospective buyer for this widget. You have to personalize those communications. If you don't want just one transaction, but you want a relationship. I try to treat the people I talk to as having a relationship. My mentor taught me long ago, he's an FBI agent, great interrogator. His goal is to get a Christmas card after the end of the interaction, okay, the next year. Now, these are people that have murdered, robbed, did horrible things.
I can't imagine his Christmas card list. It just must be crazy.
Oh, it's epic. It's epic, right? The FBI field office gets all these Christmas cards going, Martin, man, he retired like 10 years ago. Respect is everything. Look at hockey. These people beat the tar out of people for a 7-game series. And what do they do at the end? They get in a line and they shake hands and they respect each other. We got to get away from transactional sales, those types of things. You're going to win the battle, but you're going to lose the war. Is you have to treat those people with respect, because that's where you're going to get that continued business. By treating people with respect, my cases typically don't go to court because I treated them with respect. I did the right thing in the room, and it wasn't about manipulating them. It was about doing the right thing. And they knew which path they needed to go. They know they made a mistake, and I just helped them talk about it.
It's a first and foremost, a really interesting take on, you know, like law enforcement. You watch the movies, right? That's what most people have in terms of their experience with that form of law enforcement. My buddy's a Georgia State Patrolman, and so I have some background insight, but I don't get to experience that every day. Like going into the conversation and saying, I'm going to do the right thing in this room because my goal is not to nail them in court for what they've done. But what you're saying is, you know, most people actually, you're like the, you know, the psychopath or the person who doesn't have any remorse. Like those are very small percentage of people. It's a very small percentage of people. Most people know what path they should take. They're just needing someone to give them the permission to go that way. First and foremost, I really thank you for your service and approaching law enforcement that way. I think the follow-up question for you is, you are walking into a room with somebody who doesn't want to give you information. I mean, they actively should in their mind, if they're self-preserving and they have, you know, if you think of them as a rational actor, they want to protect themselves. And so you're walking into a room, you're trying to get them to open up. And I think in sales, you sort of have that similar dynamic where you have an executive, for example, who is in a room with a salesperson, and they might be willing to give a lot of information, but maybe not the information that is pertinent to creating an emotional relationship. Same thing in the room when you're interrogating, I imagine. How do you start to bridge that gap without, you know, maybe being manipulative or seeming manipulative, but actually kind of testing the waters in different areas around feel so that you bridge that conversation in probably a short amount of time? I can't imagine that you have like hours and hours and hours to interview every single person you brought into the interrogation room.
Well, I mean, the thing is in sales, I'm not trying to use this as car sales. Everybody can understand that, but you gotta understand, is this person on the phone with me where they can just hang up? Or did this person on a Saturday decide to get in their car and drive 30 miles to sit down at a dealership? They made an overt act to come here. Can we all agree that they probably want to buy a car?
Right.
Whereas somebody that gets arrested and they're in an interrogation room, I've got to get them through Miranda. They don't want to be there. I mean, we're basically selling them a timeshare. Okay, right. If you think about it.
For a place they don't want to go.
8x8 timeshare. For a place that they don't want to go, right? But you'd be surprised at how many people, you know, and what we would do is, you know, some cases you're going to have overwhelming evidence. Some cases you won't have that much evidence, but I'm going to be that person's buddy. And what I mean is I'm going to blame outside forces for why they did what they did. No, but everybody thinks they're the hero of their own adventure. Everybody thinks that they are good. The boogeyman doesn't think they're the boogeyman. So I'm going to blame people outside that room for why they did what they did or situations. Then I'm going to understand their predicament. I'm not going to maybe agree with it. Then I'm going to diminish the impact of their actions, not the culpability. Then I'm going to demonstrate tactical empathy. And then I'm going to focus on the why. So for instance, Jeb, let me throw this scenario out at you. If we look at this from a standpoint of, let's say Harry S. Truman was being interrogated for his actions in World War II. And some people be like, what do you mean? By winning the war? And I say, no, by firebombing 17 Japanese cities with napalm and then dropping
two nuclear bombs.
Yeah, right. And, you know, if we were going to interrogate Harry, what would we do? Well, we'd start off by blaming, right? We'd say we were following the Monroe Doctrine of staying in the Western Hemisphere. We were minding our own business, Harry. And here, the Empire of Japan killed 3,000 soldiers, sailors, and airmen on December 7th. So I blame an outside force. Then I would understand, hey, Harry, I totally understand why you feel like you needed to end this war, because thousands and thousands of U.S. servicemen were dying on Saipan and Peleliu and Iwo Jima every day. And then I would diminish the impact by saying, Harry, a million lives were lost by your actions, but you saved millions by ending it when you did, and keeping us from having to invade mainland Japan. Then I would demonstrate tactical empathy by telling a story. People love stories, Jeb, especially if you can personify it, because you're taking them out of the moment. We all want to hear and happily ever after. So in this situation, I would tell a story about, you remind me of someone in a predicament, like a surgeon at 2 a.m, a three-year-old kid comes in with a horrific, you know, car accident, and his leg, you're 50-50 on, should I amputate this leg? If I amputate the leg, I know that the kid's going to live. If I don't amputate the leg, the kid may die. So you make that horrible decision. That's the best worst option of taking the leg. Kind of what you did here, Harry. And then I would once again focus on the why. I'd say, Harry, and throughout time, if somebody had harnessed the power of the sun, they would have used it to conquer the world. But that's not you, because you're a man from Missouri. The buck stops here. With the Marshall Plan, you rebuilt the world. And that's what you should be proud of. So that's how you talk to people, right? That's how you sell people. That's how you sell jail. I'm not going to say you did it. Tell me about it. You're a liar. No, I'm not. You're going to talk to people, and you're going to, first off, we're going to get what we can out of them on the front side with that FEEL acronym, where we're going to try to understand what makes them tick. And then how can we leverage that? And then also, it's amazing what you can learn from people by their surroundings, by looking around and seeing what's in the room. You know, what's their priorities, right? Do they have 18 pictures of their family in their office? Well, what am I probably going to focus on? Probably going to focus on that family, right? So it's amazing what people will put out there for you if you're just willing to take a second and look.
I think this is a really good segue into the next part of this conversation I wanted to get to, because you talk about, you know, this interview with Harry S. Truman, which I would love to play out with you a million times this Sunday. I think it'd just be so much fun to have that conversation about the consequences of that person's particular actions and what context they were in, which is really helpful to these conversations. You have to have a lot of self-awareness in these conversations, is mental jujitsu, Brazilian mental jujitsu at a thousand miles an hour. You're trying to like know heuristics, let's see the environment. You're trying to have these conversations where you're not interrogating, you're getting them to open up and build an emotional connection with you. And that, you know, sales, you have that similar situation. You mentioned, like, the thing is like a little deeper in your book is like chapter 8, I believe, where you were interviewing someone who was actually financial crime. So it's something a little different than counterfeiting money, or like, you know, something to do with children, or something way more violent. It's just somebody sitting in an office clicking buttons doing crime. You do the interview, and then you end up having to pull like a mentor into the room, and they touch you. I think I wrote this down, but I don't know if this is what you called it, but the like a Yoda moment. So they like this self-awareness moment. Tell me a little bit about that story and then what lesson you learned from your mentor.
Yeah, Jeb. So this was an individual that had taught me at polygraph school, and somebody I looked up to, because he's from South Philly. Grew up hard, had done everything in the Secret Service, just somebody that had been around forever. And we would call him Yoda, because this guy was just otherworldly with how he would talk to people. And he called me and he asked me if I could assist on a case. He was a supervisor down in this field office a couple years later. And I'm still young. I'm not in my 30s yet. And this individual had been accused of doing $2 million of fraud. And I won't get overly specific, but the position he was in was a very CEO level type position. He was doing very, very well for himself, but he was probably early 60s, close to retirement. He had a lot on the line and he had a lot to lose. And so I wanted to do well by my mentor. And so I prepped. I knew this case backward and forward. I had a dossier on this individual. Like, I had everything planned out, from what we were going to eat to this, to that, how we were going to take him into custody so he could save face. I thought I had it planned out perfectly. And a couple hours into talking to him, he just kind of looked at me, sized me up, and goes, "What's next?" And it was the way he just said it was with almost contempt, respect, but a little bit of like, "Son, I'm old enough to be your dad."
Yeah.
Okay. And I kind of viewed that as, and thankfully, I had learned from my other mentors that it's not about you. It's about the person crossing you. It's about the team. It's about the mission. And so I took a quick break and I went to my Yoda who was there and I said, he needs another gray haired, Yoda. He needs you to come in. And that's all it was. He came in. He said nothing different than what I said. But sometimes you are not the right person to unlock that, you know, that lock. You are just, you don't have the right key. You just don't have the presence. You're not the right crayon in the Crayola box. You can't take that personal. You just have to view what's the team effort. And thankfully, by dropping the ego down, we were able to accomplish the mission. But that was a hard lesson to learn, but I think it was a very valuable one for me.
I like that it's better to, you know, lose as a team than to lose alone. It's better to win as a team than to win alone. We do this a lot at Sales Gravy, which is, we call it team selling. And I bring this up because I want to get more insights into this specific dynamic you had where, you know, you think of like your sales rep. That guy probably had sales conversations with sales reps who looked like me and looked like you at the time. You know, I'm 28 yeah. years old and they're thinking, what are you going to bring to me that I had already know I'm your superior, or there's a power dynamic shift. I have been in situations where I am certainly not the right person to sell that or to have that conversation. When you bring in your mentor, you know, when you have that self-awareness, I think especially with the Secret Service, there's probably more of this built in than the lone wolf sales rep who's getting commission on a deal. But winning as a team, how did you all sort of have that conversation with one another? Maybe, you know, if you could just maybe extrapolate it to, it's not just that, hey, I need you to tap in here. What are you saying to one another? What is the body language? What is the kind of the vibe of that room of like, I am not the right person? I'm sure there was sort of some like, you're putting your ego out there a little bit too. Like, what's the team going through at that moment?
Yeah, we would have kind of a call to the bullpen that we had worked out ahead of time where I would touch my watch and my partner would touch his watch. And that's when we knew call the bullpen. Because if you call it out, then it sounds like in sales when you're like, hey, I'm going to go get the manager. I'm going to call in the reliever here. People see through that, right? So you can't make it overt. I don't want to lessen myself in the eyes of the person that I'm across from. But like you said, it's all about team first. That was going to be a long flight home if we lost. But like you said, if I lost because it wasn't about my ego, if I lost because we tried everything we could, that's going to happen. There's no such thing as winning every game, right? Mm. Even the Super Bowl champs are going to lose 2 or 3 games every year, right? That's just the way it works. So like you said, I like how you said it. Losing as a team is that sometimes you're going to lose. But if you've done everything you could, then you can sleep well at night. And if you do it right and you do it ethically, because you can try to goose those numbers a little bit by going into those gray areas or those manipulative areas, but you're going to lose the war by doing that. So doing the right thing, having high integrity, and doing it truly as a team. So we would call to the bullpen in those situations because we would have that a lot. One of my partners was a Marine. So if I've got somebody that, you know, is in the armed services, you think that would not be a connection, especially if they're in the Marine Corps? One of my partners went to the Citadel, and in South Carolina where I'm at, a lot of the people I talked to understood the Citadel, or they knew somebody from the Citadel. They would look at his ring and they weren't even looking at me. Well, if I have my ego step up and be like, no, listen to me. I want you to look at me. I've lost all the respect. Just let it flow. Okay. So like I said, work as a team. You're going to find that some people naturally gravitate towards other people, but just make it this. It's not about you. It's about the other person. Robin Drake wrote a great book, FBI Profiler. It's not about you. Okay. It's about the other person. And that's how he would recruit foreign sources as an FBI agent, because you don't make it about yourself and your wins and losses. You make it about national security. It's about, you know, the whole.
This is, I think from a team selling or sales perspective, this is not about you is so important for so many aspects of it, including the just you're going to get rejected a lot. You're going to get told no a lot. You're going to lose those deals. And then it's not about you is really helpful for that, but also for the team selling test. We talked a lot today about, and this is my last question, about the mechanisms and skills and conversations we can have with somebody to build trust and build a relationship with somebody that helps us ultimately get to our goal of, you know, talking about what product service we can do to help their business, whatever that might be. You have some really interesting stories about fast food and not about eating it, not about you eating it, but just buying it for people. And then it just opened up a world within the, you know, within that realm that you maybe wouldn't have found otherwise. So it's a simple lesson, but it's so profound. Could you talk us through the litmus test of McDonald's?
Yeah. So McDonald's, Wendy's, you know, whatever you got, I think offering something to somebody, I don't care if it's a bottle of water, you know, you talk to the old school car salesman, what they'll do is they'll have a pocket full of change and they talk to their people that they're trying to sell to that are seated, you know, after maybe taking a test drive, hey, what can I get you to drink? And they'll walk over there and they'll dig and you can hear that change and they plop that change in there and they come back and they bring that Coke, that Diet Coke, whatever. What does that say to that person? That person gave something that was theirs and they provided these potential buyers something, and that's going to impart in them. It's reciprocity. You give to get. But it's more so about that they took something of theirs and they gave it to you. It's what we would do when somebody comes to our house. Last night at the Super Bowl parties, when you come in, what do people do? Hey, here's where the restroom is. What can I get you to eat? What can I get you to drink? That's about treating people with respect. But food for me is we're used to talking around the dinner table. Plus, it also helps with listening because it forces you. When you're eating, what are you not doing? You're not talking. So sometimes you become a good listener just because you shut up, okay? but so providing that to somebody. Plus, when people are hangry, they get short with you. They don't, you know, converse as well. But it's also a good barometer. If somebody doesn't eat food, Jeb, that I provide them, what it says to me is they're in a nervous state and they're not in the right headspace. I'm trying to create that Catholic confessional for them. Why do people talk in a Catholic confessional? Because it's private, because they're not being judged, because they're in a safe place. So I'm trying to create that safe pace. So food for me, what I would do a lot of times is I would, if they're social media, I can think of one case in particular. It was really bad offenders, but it was a male-female offender. And I started with the male first, and on his social media, he was a big Wendy's fan. So I made it a point to be like, hey, what can I get you? You know, you like Wendy's? Oh man, it's my favorite. Well, I'll tell you what, I was just going to get two biggies and, you know, a Frosty and supersized fries. Is that good? Oh my God, you're amazing, right? So I give $20 from my pocket to the detective and they bring that back. Well, what does that say about me? I'm a stand-up guy. What does that look like to a juror? I'm a stand-up guy. And I was hungry. All right. So,
and it serves that purpose. You got to eat and you got to look good. So perfect.
Wonderful. Right. And it's one of those things where, you know, now his blood sugar is where it needs to be. So if he's innocent or he's guilty, he's going to be in a better headspace to talk. And then we followed that up about an hour later with talking to the female, and I did the same thing, but she was a McDonald's fan. So we got Big Mac, supersized fries, an orange drink, and a shake. I had a bad GI. My GI wasn't in great shape after that. But on the jail call the next day, I think she called somebody and said, yeah, they got me with the McDonald's. That's why I confessed. And I'm like, whatever, $10 to get you to talk about doing this horrific act, whatever it takes. But you know, when you feed people, when you just treat people with the basic respect, how would you want to be treated? That's kind of the larger point. But I like how you pulled that one out of the book. That was a good day.
Just simple, like the golden rule, treat others like you want to be treated. I mean, I like the, you know, the term like creating the Catholic confessional, but giving people a safe space to just open up and that for sales, right? So you talk about this in an interrogation room, but this could be that you're in these conversations with people, like literally a $20 Starbucks gift card. I am a client of a vendor and they send me a note with maybe like a little coffee thing, or they give me a little gift card to go get some food in the middle of the day. And that dopamine association, whether or not it's kind of hokey when I got the gift card, mm-hmm. It's kind of hokey when you walked in with a bag of McDonald's. I'm sure they were like, all right, this guy's trying to get, but once you really realize the gift of what they gave you, you sort of have that positive association. So such a great lesson there. You have so much in this book. I wish I could have gotten to every single question I had in those conversations with all of these incredible people that just ended up in your book and then became really great lessons for conversations. I want people to go check out your book. It's called Tell Me Everything. But Brad, where can people follow you, get more information, and then ultimately where can they buy your book and start reading so they can build a more strong emotional connections with their clients?
Yeah, thanks, Jeb. Comes out February 17th. You can get it at bradleybeeler.com or anywhere books are sold. I know most people go to Amazon nowadays, but Tell Me Everything. And then my monikers on social media are Brad Beeler 1865 on LinkedIn and also Instagram. I like to put a lot of content on there. So if I can do anything for any of your listeners, feel free to reach out.
Awesome. Brad, well, thank you so much for joining us on the Sales Gravy podcast. And thank you so much for telling us about your book. I'm going to recommend this for everyone listening to this podcast. And if you haven't gotten to the YouTube side of Sales Gravy, go to youtube.com/SalesGravy. You can watch this conversation with me and Brad. He's got these awesome challenge coins behind him and all kinds of cool things. If you ask him nicely, he'll show you his Rolling Stones magazine that got signed by the $8 million scammer out of Chicago. Follow him everywhere you can. Otherwise, we will catch you next time on the Sales Gravy podcast. Remember to give us a 5-star rating wherever you are and leave us a comment.
Hi, I'm Jeb Blunt, bestselling author of Fanatical Prospecting, Sales EQ, Objections Inked, and my brand new book, The LinkedIn Edge. You know, companies and people from all over the world come to me to get answers to their toughest sales and growth questions. And that's why I created Ask Jeb. There's a segment on the Sales Gravy podcast where you can come and ask me anything. If you want to get on the show, just go to salesgravy.com/ask. That's salesgravy.com/ask. One of our great producers will get you on and you can ask me anything about sales.
The Sales Gravy Podcast is sponsored by Nooks. Nooks is a signal-first workspace that turns real-time intent into real conversations. Their AI agents monitor LinkedIn and CRM signals to tell your team exactly who to reach and what to say. Think of it as having an agent that thinks exactly like your best rep. And when it comes to tools, you can stop searching and start winning with Nooks. So check out Agent Workspace for Sales at nooks.ai. That's Nooks.ai.